you can try and think of it more along the lines, more akin to an investment. It's something that you take out now to provide for you in the future.
Hello, welcome to episode 8 of the Dental Head Start podcast. Can you imagine spending all this time studying, getting to where we are, and finally earning an income, all to have an injury stop you from being able to work, stop you from being able to earn anything, paying back those debts or moving forward in life? I really couldn't imagine this, and one of the first things I did was get income protection. And I think this is a pretty important topic because I've actually seen someone have to use it, and I hope never to use any of my insurances, but it's something I'll never let lapse. Our guest this week is an insurance specialist, and he runs a business specifically for those in the medical field. Mark Rothney is a financial advisor specializing in insurance and runs Rothney Financial Security. The chat with Mark today was really quite good. We covered a lot that you need to know about insurance, things that will help you understand that you're covered properly. This included different types of insurance, when graduates should consider getting insurance. And I found this interesting, and it makes a really good point. The difference between stepped and level premiums, clauses that can catch you out, and what you should do at claim time to make sure it goes smoothly. This is such an important topic. I really hope you enjoy the chat today with Mark. So tonight we've got something different. We don't have a dentist on the podcast tonight. We actually have someone who is an insurance specialist, a financial advisor who helps dentists specifically or medical specifically out with insurance. And it's something that a lot of graduates really don't have a lot of idea about. So welcome to the podcast, Mark Rothney. How are you tonight?
Hi, David. Thanks very much. I'm having a great day. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you this evening.
Well, thank you for spending the time with us and sharing some of your thoughts with dental graduates and students. So, Mark, before we start, you've got a few words to say, the official bit. Do you want to get that over and done with?
Absolutely. I just really need to make sure that everyone is aware that anything I discuss tonight or any points I make must really be considered as general advice only. It's not intended to be legal, taxation, or financial advice. You should not act on anything that I discuss here tonight without seeking personal advice on your particular circumstances.
That sounds like a bit of good advice there. I think the same for anything I've ever said in any of my podcasts as well. So good point, Mark. So Mark, what do you do? What is your actual title, and where do you work?
So I actually am the founder and managing director of Rothney Financial Security. It's a business that concentrates solely on risk insurance. So risk insurance is different to general insurance. Risk insurance covers the spectrum of income protection insurance, life insurance, total and permanent disability, and trauma insurance. So general insurance insures things. I insure people and the effects on people. I deal only with in the medical profession. I got into the industry about 17 years ago, and I only work with medical professionals around, in particular, income protection insurance.
So how did you get involved in insurance or financial advice in general?
Interesting story, because it was actually my financial advisor. In a previous life, I was managing a business in the building industry. I was working 14 to 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, basically just killing myself. And I became pretty good friends with my financial advisor. And after a number of years, I sort of gave him an indication of how weary I'd become of the building industry. And he suggested that I consider a change in professions, and went and had a look at what he did and the good that he was doing. Went and did the study and started out on my own in probably late 2001, early 2002. And I've been loving it ever since. So it has its trials and tribulations, but overall, it's a great profession.
That sounds good. I think all professions, especially if you're passionate about it, has its good and its bad. It's funny how those people that you meet early on make such a big difference in your life. And like for me, I met a dentist and ended up working as a dental assistant, and obviously now I'm a dentist, so big impact on your life. So you've been doing it for 17 years. Have you been specialized in insurance for 17 years?
Yep, and insurance, and in particular in medical professionals in the last 7 years. As you'd be well aware from your side, depending on which field of medicine you're in, it's there's a lot of complexities to learn about your particular industry, how it works, how you're paid, how your businesses are structured. There's so much to learn in that you can't just walk into it. And it really comes down to, and it's going to be something that I think you're going to hear a lot from me tonight, is about the value of advice. A product is just effectively a PDF or a book with all the details of the policy, but it really comes down to the quality of the advice that you get to make sure that you implement that policy correctly in your particular circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, a patient coming in asking for a certain type of treatment. If the advice underlying all the diagnosis per se is not right, well, there's no point at all. So Mark, we've had a good chat about this, and you know, this podcast is it's aimed at students and dental graduates, so earlier in our careers, although a lot of different people listen to it. For those specific people, new graduates, is insurance important for them?
It is, vitally so, and there's two reasons for it. One is that if we look at the earning potential of a dentist, say if we look at a taxable income of $200,000 for an associate, graduating 24, 25 years of age, working through to 65. And I've had a lot of my clients that have said that, you know, they don't intend to work at that age. And quite often you don't, but you tend to stay working because you love what you do. So if we look at the earnings over that sort of 40-year lifespan, you're looking at, even without indexation, you're looking at earning $8 million. And that's without the compounding effect of investing and, as I said, the CPI indexation side of it. So from there, that's if we look at the assets that you have in your life over the next 40 years, your income and the ability to earn that income is most important. So
yeah, absolutely. You paint a pretty picture. so it makes you think, oh, wow, where does that all go?
Well, a lot of it goes to the taxation office, which you're always going to get to know fairly well. But the second point I wanted to really make about the importance of it is that none of us ever intend on taking out insurance. And I can tell you right now, insurance is a grudge purchase. It's not something that any of us ever willingly want to take out, and it's certainly not something that we want to claim upon. But at the end of the day, it's a grudge purchase. So let's make sure that you take it out as early as possible, because as humans, we're naturally tilted towards being very positive. It's what dragged us out of the primordial swamps, you know, tens of thousands or millions of years ago. So from that perspective, there's always the vision that nothing's ever going to happen to us. You know, we're always going to be fine, we're bulletproof and all the rest of it. The problem is that in dentistry, I know from a statistics point of view through the Australian Bureau of Statistics, that neck pain, cervical spine pain is a big issue, particularly with young dentists. I find that through my experiences, you tend to the pathway seems to be you graduate, you'll go out and you'll start working, and then all of a sudden, from where you go from university doing some prac to working 8 to 10 hours, sometimes 12 hours a day on a big day, hunched over a patient, things, you know, you haven't developed the musculature in that part of your spine yet, so you end up getting a stiff neck, going and seeing a physiotherapist, doing work on your posture, buying a good quality pair of loops. So, and then quite often that tends to heal and correct itself. But the problem is, if you apply for insurance, particularly income protection insurance, once you've started experiencing pain in that area, an exclusion is almost certainly going to be applied to that part of your spine. Now, as treatment ceases and you stop experiencing symptoms in that area, we can get that that exclusion reviewed, possibly removed. But, you know, you don't ever want to have an exclusion on your policy if we can at all avoid it. A client of mine, a young dentist, under 30, we set up his income protection policy only 18 months ago. He'd been out for 4 or 5 years. So his policy's only been in force 18 months ago. He went out for a bike ride on a Sunday morning about 2 months ago, and had an accident. There was no other vehicle or involved or anything. He just came off his bicycle, and now a paraplegic. So,
wow. Oh, man.
Yeah,
that's tough to hear, but it can happen.
Yeah, that's ultimately the cruel irony of life, is that it can dish up unexpected events.
Yeah, for sure. That hits pretty close to home for me. I ride a lot. I don't ride on the road. I ride mountain bikes a fair amount, but I got insurance income protection that literally as soon as I could. And it was actually because that dentist that got me into dentistry, he's, you know, used his income protection before, and I saw that firsthand and how important it was. So I got it straight away. I didn't want to stop doing the things that I love, because the whole point of working is to enjoy your life. But at the same time, I went straight to get income protection. It took me another year and a half to figure out the rest of it, which we'll talk more about the differences and why. But yeah, I think that's pretty important stuff.
Something to keep in mind on that too, also, Dave, is that in Australia, our Life Insurance Contract Act is incredibly strong in favour of the consumer. So the way it works with life income protection, total and permanent disability, trauma insurance, is the policies are what they call guaranteed renewable. So what that means is, when you go to take out a policy, they'll ask you a set of incredibly invasive questions. There may be a test or a height, weight, urinalysis sort of check. But once that policy is in force, and providing you've met your duty of disclosure, so you've told them everything you would be expected to know about your medical history and your personal habits, then that insurer can't ever come back and change that policy on you. Irrespective of if you make 10 claims on that income protection policy a year, even to a degree where if you take up smoking, as long as you don't give the opportunity to that insurer to re-underwrite you via, say, looking to increase your cover, they can't come back and change that premiums. They can't come back and try and place an exclusion on the policy after it's in force. So from that extent, it just is yet another reason that people should consider insurances as soon as they're financially able to afford them.
Yeah, if you insure young when you're healthy, then you won't be you'll have exclusions. I think that I firsthand, when I did re-underwrite myself to go through a whole new round, and I had to go and get like an echocardiogram because I had a bit of a heart flutter. My heart's absolutely fine, but I had to go through all this rigmarole, and then it took about like 4 months to get it done. So, and that's because I had mentioned it to the GP. So the bottom line is, students and graduates, if you're healthy and well, get it right now. or as soon as you have an income that you can protect. Don't tell your GP anything. That's not advice. That's not advice. Please don't do that. So there's a couple of different key types of insurance that you talk about. Income protection is one of them. Can you just define that and then give us a bit of an idea of what the other ones are?
Sure. So income protection in its most basic form is, obviously, it's an insurance policy that protects your ability to earn. So it covers you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, anywhere in the world against disability. So whether that's physical or mental. As a general rule, the premiums are generally tax deductible to you. And also, if you go on claim, two things happen. One is that the benefit that they pay you is deemed as taxable income, so you will need to pay tax out of that. And secondly, when you go on claim, you will stop paying premiums. So if you're on claim for 6 months, you don't pay premiums for those 6 months of that year.
Hmm.
So...
Now, with income protection, there's quite a few. You can structure it in a few different ways. Like you can get a month before you actually get paid out, or longer or shorter. I guess while we're talking about income protection, what do you advise there, and what makes sense?
It really comes down to individual circumstances, but the parameters. I mean, the first question with income protection I get is, "What's it going to cost me?" And that's a fair enough question. So, for us to work out a premium, then we need to, the client then needs to make some choices. The first one is the wait period. So that's how long that you have to be off work for that you don't get paid for. So essentially, that's what they call self-insurance. So, for example, you mentioned a one-month wait. You have a choice between a one-month, two-month, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, and 2 years. The longer the wait, the cheaper the premium. So, say, for example, if you have a 30-day wait and you're off work for 6 months, you will receive 5 months benefits.
Hmm. So it makes a pretty significant... I imagine as you bring that down, it would be very significantly more expensive.
Absolutely. But the way I sort of explain it to my clients when we're going through that, say, for example, if you're insured for $10,000 a month and you've got a choice between a 30-day wait and a 60-day wait, and the difference in the premium is $500 a year. So the way I look at it is that if you hold that policy for 10 years, the cost to you in premium is $5,000 over those 10 years. But because the premium is generally tax deductible to you, your true net cost is really closer to $2,500 a year. Okay.
Yeah.
If you make one claim through that 10-year time, what you would have been paid on a 30-day wait, you would have been paid a $10,000 benefit 1 month sooner than you would have done if you took out a 60-day wait. So for the sake of $2,500 cost, you've forsaken a $10,000 benefit.
Yeah. So it makes sense, pay a little more. And I guess that would cover you for things like, you know, those injuries that only take you out for a month and a half or 2 months, for instance, which would probably be more common than any claim over, say, a year.
Definitely. And I always recommend to my graduates that consider, particularly young people, everyone wants to get in, they play sports. So whether that be going to the gym, bicycle riding, whatever, it's always worth considering. You can always add to your policy what they call an accident option. So you're covered for accidental injury as a standard policy term. But if you add the accident option, what it does do is it reduces your wait period from 30 days or 60 days down to 3 days. So say, for example, if you were riding your bike on a weekend and you fell off and you sprained your wrist and you're off work for 2 weeks, you would then be paid for those 2 weeks because it was the result of an accident. And I always suggest that if you are playing any sort of sports or active, consider having the accident option, even if it's just for the first few years of having the policy. And then once you've built up a bit of a cash buffer behind you, we can always look at dropping that accident option off in a few years' time. There's no underwriting involved, and your premium will then drop accordingly.
Is there underwriting involved to add something like an accident protection?
Yes. The general rule of thumb is that the way an insurer looks at it is if they're increasing their risk, then there'll be underwriting. If they're reducing their risks, i.e. if you're removing a benefit or if you're increasing your wait time or if you're reducing the sum insured, there'll be no underwriting involved.
That makes sense. All right. So what other ones are there? There's income protection and then there's the life insurance as well?
Yep, absolutely. So with what they call lump sum insurances, so that encompasses life insurance, total and permanent disability cover, and trauma cover. So life insurance that's really the one you don't want to claim on because that means you've passed away or you've had that conversation with your doctor where they said you're going to pass away at some stage in the next 2 years. So that's there for your family. Life insurance is for your family. So it's for the people that you leave behind. As a graduate, quite often I see that you graduate with maybe some HECS debt or some FEHELP debt, no children, you're not married, no debt. So really life insurance isn't a major factor to consider at that time. With regards to your HECS debt and FEHOLP, if you pass away in Australia, then those debts are forgiven by the government. So there's no issues there. I would suggest you may want to consider it if your parents or siblings are financially dependent upon you and it would impact them greatly. So if your parents have made a large financial sacrifice to get you through uni, then maybe you'd want to consider life insurance. But realistically, if you're young, single, no kids, no debt, life insurance is something that you could probably wait until you get some debt or children.
That's interesting. The reason I just did my insurance is because I had a child. So, good. I made the right decision. Thanks, hey, Mark.
You ticked all the boxes so far, David, from our chats. The next one is what they call total and permanent disability. So total and permanent disability is if due to accident or sickness, physical or mental, if you can't ever return to work in your chosen profession as a dentist, then you will be paid out a lump sum. So if you try and look at it this way, that financially, if you could never ever return to work again, the impact financially on your family is very similar as to if you were to pass away.
Yeah.
So you know, if you had a mortgage or children or something along those lines, then again, you would want to consider total and permanent disability. Where I do suggest that it is worth considering is that if we look at it this way, say if you're you're a 25-year-old dentist, you take out income protection insurance, you're just renting a nice unit somewhere and something happens and you get, say, a crush injury to your dominant hand and there's no more surgical work, then keep in mind you're a 25-year-old. To be a dentist, you're obviously incredibly bright and usually quite ambitious. So if you've got just income protection insurance, then great, you've got an income stream coming in for the rest of your working life. But you're not always going to want to rent a unit. You know, there will always want to get to a stage, I'd imagine, in the future where you're going to want to have some sort of financial independence. And even the basic one of that is to own your own home. Of some sort, whether that be a house or a unit. So where I suggest total and permanent disability cover may be appropriate is that if you were in that scenario, you'd have then a tax-free lump sum to go out and purchase a property in your own name, and you won't then have to use your income protection benefit to try and pay a mortgage off in the future. So again, insurance is always about a worst-case scenario. And protecting you. So probably a point that I would like to try and get across with insurance is insurance as it's viewed as, say, car insurance or house insurance is just, the general view is that it's just a once a year pay and it's out the way. With life insurances and income protection insurances, if you can try and think of it more along the lines, more akin to an investment. So with an investment, it's something that you take out now to provide for you in the future, 15, 20, 30 years in the future. We don't ever take out, you want to take out insurances with the view that you're going to be holding them for the long term. That way then it'll promote better behavior in that find the right insurer the first time so you're not chopping and changing insurers, and I'll get into why you shouldn't do that later on. Whether you take out a stepped or a level premium structure, there's different times in your life that you should consider those. And you can set it up so that if in the future something happens, that investment will pay rich dividends for you.
Yeah. So you mentioned did you stepped and level premiums.
Yes.
Where does that apply, and what does that mean?
So the difference between stepped and level premiums are. The way they're calculated and the premium rates that they're calculated on. So a stepped premium is calculated based upon your age today and then recalculated each and every single year after that based upon your older age.
Hmm.
So think of it a bit like a bell curve that through your 20s into your early 30s, there really isn't a lot of change in your premiums. Once you sort of get to around 34, 35, you'd notice that those premium increases each year have become a little bit larger. And those increases will continue to get larger each and every year that you hold that policy. On the other hand, a level premium is, as a rule of thumb, it's around about 30% more expensive initially, but in theory, that premium rate is locked in for the life of the policy. So
as a younger person, you would save money being on stepped, and it's early on when you're not earning as much. That sounds like a good idea. Is that generally the case, or does it depend a lot more on other things?
There's a couple of other factors. Generally, though, with the type of cover for income protection, I recommend to all of my graduates that you've graduated, you're a first or second year graduate. We don't have a crystal ball. We don't know what's going to happen with your career over the next 5 to 7 years. We don't know. You might go back and do more study, become a specialist. You might do more crown and bridge work, root canals, injectables. You may move out to a rural practice. You may get into a corporate. You know, some of the biggest earning clients I've got that are associates are in the big corporate offices. So whilst we don't know where your income is going to level out at, I suggest that with income protection, there's absolutely no issue at all starting off taking that on a step premium. The premium rates for both step and level.
Would you then change to a level?
Absolutely. Absolutely. At around about 30, early 30s, I find that's the perfect time to look at considering changing over to a level premium structure. By then, generally, your life will have taken its form. If you're going to get married, you'll get married. If you're going to start a family, you'll have started a family or know when you're going to start a family. Your debt level will generally have stabilized. If you're going to get into practice ownership or specialties, you'll have made those decisions. Your income will generally have found its most favorable position in regards to a work-life balance. So when it plateaus, it's a perfect time to then look at locking in a level premium. And this is one of my bugbears. I have a lot of young graduates come to me for just a look over or a review of their existing income protection. And these are 25-year-olds that have been set up on a level premium straight up from day one with income protection. And to me, I just don't necessarily think it suits their particular needs. I've actually done the cumulative premiums on someone, a 25-year-old, taking out a level premium and holding that all the way through to 65 with the same insurer. And then I've done the sums on a 25-year-old taking out a step premium policy and at 34 years of age, changing over to a level premium policy. And it actually works out cheaper by doing it the way that I suggest, because you're not paying...
How significant is that difference?
A level premium over the life of that policy for a male non-smoker in New South Wales is about $191,000 over the life of the policy in premiums. By starting on stepped and converting to level, it works out at about $172,000 over the life of the policy.
So yeah, okay.
It's not insignificant, but it's more around giving you the flexibility to adjust your cover, because one of the downsides of a level premium is that if you've been with that insurer for 3 or 4 years and they radically change their product or bring out a new product, or, for example, get sold, which quite a few of life insurance companies are being sold at the moment, then if you consider changing an insurers, then you're losing the benefit that you potentially had by paying that extra 30% premium for those 3 years. Haven't given yourself the time to realise the financial benefit of a level premium structure. So
yeah, okay. So it makes quite a difference, particularly to us in our early years. So that's really good advice. We talked about, so we've got TPD, which is if you get injured but still alive, you get a lump sum. You've got life insurance if you die or are terminally ill. Income protection if you can't work. But then there's trauma. And that one's always confused me a bit. What's trauma?
So, trauma, a lot of people, and it can be quite easy to confuse trauma and total and permanent disability. So total and permanent disability isn't concerned, it's not medically specific. It just says if due to disability, you can't ever work again as a dentist, we will pay you X amount of dollars. Trauma insurance is very medical condition specific. So, for example, it will pay you a tax-free lump sum in the event of diagnosis of malignant cancer or a stroke, heart attack, blindness, deafness, paraplegia, quadriplegia, things like that. Those funds are paid to you tax-free, and they're generally used to cover the gap between your medical insurance and the true cost. So cover those out-of-pocket expenses.
I was going to say, so do they ever pay out together?
Absolutely. So trauma insurance can and is very often paid out in concert with income protection. Total and permanent disability is often paid out with income protection. They don't, they're not in conflict at all.
Hmm.
They don't counteract each other. You can get paid out a trauma insurance benefit and a total and permanent disability benefit for the same condition. It's not common, but it can happen. So if I use as an
example, right? So they're all kind of concurrent policies that are independent of each other.
Absolutely. So trauma insurance, for example, with malignant cancer. So it's something horrible that none of us ever really want to experience, and it'll turn your life upside down for 12 to 18 months to 2 years. But in Australia, we've got a fantastic treatment and survival rate. So if, for example, you had bowel cancer, you're off work 6 months with chemo, radiation. The difference between the two policies is that you would be paid under a trauma policy because it's a malignant cancer. But because of the fact that it's highly likely that you will recover and will be able to return to your occupation as a dentist, that wouldn't meet the definition to be paid out under total and permanent disability.
Yeah, that makes sense. So in considering that, you're talking about this, working as a dentist, you used that a few times. And we had a question from someone on Facebook, Nadine, and she asked you to explain the own occupation option with insurance. She also asked about any other small but important points to look out for. Is that own occupation, is that what you mean as when you say working as a dentist? And is it possible to have a policy where you actually aren't covered?
Absolutely. So own occupation is relevant to both income protection insurance and total and permanent disability, but in slightly different ways. I'll cover total and permanent disability first. So, for example, with total and permanent disability, you can have an own occupation definition or you can have an any occupation definition. Total and permanent disability cover owned entirely within super funds. And this doesn't matter. I'm not picking on industry funds, any sort of super fund. It's a government regulation that under the Superannuation Act, total and permanent disability within super must or can only be in any occupation. So for you to be able to meet that definition as a dentist, you've got to be unable to ever return to any occupation you're suitable for through retraining, prior learning or re-education. The problem is that with the high degree of education you've got, even with severe cognitive loss, if in that event that your treating doctor is asked by the insurer, is there anything they could do? Oh, well, they could probably do basic clerical work. Then you don't meet that definition. So you won't be eligible for a benefit payment. So the alternative then is to pay a higher premium and take out what they call an own occupation. So that's where if you can't return your own occupation as a dentist, you will meet the definition and you will be paid that lump sum.
So it's an absolutely critical point for every single dentist and there's no way you'd ever want anything else.
Yep, absolutely. Ironically, without picking on concreters, for example, but some blue-collar workers, they would find it a lot easier to meet in any occupation definition purely because of the fact that if they've got low levels of education, they're harder to retrain, they would meet it. So in a way, you can almost be punished for studying hard and being intelligent.
So yeah, definitely get own occupation. So anything you've got in your super fund won't meet that either. That's pretty important, because a lot of people probably think, oh yeah, I've got life or some or TPD, or I'm not even sure, in super, and that wouldn't help a dentist really that much.
No, you as a dentist, you really need to be in a vegetative state to meet that definition. It's really tough.
Yeah, good point. Is there any other small points that are in the contracts with insurance that can catch dentists or especially young dentists out?
Well, where does it stop, really, unfortunately? I mean, the problem with insurance is that they're a contract between the premium payer and the person insured and the insurance company. So they have lawyers draft the contracts, and unfortunately, usually we're not lawyers to be able to read it. So going further on to Nadine's question about own occupation with income protection, of the roughly 30 retail income protection policies available on the Australian market today, virtually all of them will, in their PDS, say that they will cover you for your own occupation. And that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But what is a lot harder to find in that PDS, and sometimes it won't be in the product disclosure statement, it'll be in the policy document itself, is if that policy actually contains what they call capability clauses. So a capability clause is where, again, let's use the example that you've had a crush injury to your dominant hand, so no more surgical work, that's the end of your dental career, that they then can turn around and say, well, okay, you are disabled enough that you can't perform your occupation as a dentist, but there's nothing stopping you returning to work in a part-time capacity in a slightly different occupation, or, for example, as a lecturer at university, or even as a manager in a dental practice. Now, my view is that if something like that did happen and it ended your career and you wanted to go back to university as a lecturer, that should be your choice and not the insurance company's choice.
Yeah, for sure.
Ask any insurer about these clauses, and they'll say, oh, yes, but we don't invoke them very often. Well, insurance companies in the last 5 years have done nothing but lose money hand over fist on income protection insurance policies, hence why there's been increases in premiums for income protection nearly every year for the last 3 to 5 years. And if they've got someone insured that they're looking at paying $8 million out over the next 40 years, I can tell you now, they will be invoking those clauses.
Why have they had a seemingly lost over the last 5 years?
Well, insurance companies bring money in via premiums paid every month, and then they cover their overhead, so they pay their staff and they sponsor things like the Australian Open and things like that. And then the money that's left over goes towards claims. Now, sitting in the middle of that pot before they pay those claims, they have billions of dollars. Life insurance companies are such cash-rich businesses. They have so much liquid cash available, and that's according to the APRA Act, that they must be really liquid. So they've actually got to hold 30% of their insured liabilities as liquid assets in case there's a natural disaster of some sort, to make sure that they're financially stable enough to work well and truly into the future. And what insurers have done in the past is they've invested those liquid assets into the overnight money markets and short-term things. And they've been able to pick up, 5-7% return on funds. And that's really helped subsidize their claims. Now, with interest rates in Australia sitting at 1.5% with reasonable likelihood they could go down, America at 1.75, Japan's virtually zero, Europe's not much better, they're not getting any return on those funds and therefore no subsidy on their claims. So every dollar that they're paying out in claim is virtually coming out of their own pocket. And there also has been a spike in claims over the last 5 years for both mental health and musculoskeletal.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. It's a big thing in our industry, both of those things, musculoskeletal and mental health. And I can imagine there's a lot more people claiming it, the more people diagnose it, I guess, and deal with it properly.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I think a lot of things, particularly around mental health, went undiagnosed for so many years, whether people even recognized that they had them and just were having, just going through a rough trot at the moment or whatever, I think. And overall, as a for our health, we're going to be better, but we're just going through a transition phase at the moment where the insurers are wearing the brunt of it. But I can tell you now, they're clamping down a lot tougher, particularly for dentists, around mental health and musculoskeletal. So,
in what way do you mean by clamping down? Are they being much more looking into your claim a lot deeper? Is that what you mean?
Not so much claim. They're looking, they're tougher at underwriting time. So they're, you know, for example, I've had clients where they've, with the incredibly high pressure and workload that you have through university, where you may have gone and seen a counsellor just to be able to talk and vent about some things, or had a rough breakup with a girlfriend or a boyfriend or whatever, and you just go and talk, which is the best thing to do. But of course, that then is on the record, and if they go to apply for insurance in the next few years after that, it's really likely that there would be a mental health exclusion applied on that policy until they've been treatment and symptom free for up to 5 years. So, it can be tough. They are clamping down. So,
they it sounds like they kind of can decide whatever they want. Is there any limitation on them? Like, do they have to? How do they know that that was something that can give them, you know, allow them to say that?
About the exclusion?
Yeah, how can they exclude just on a consultation with someone in that field? Can they be that broad?
Yep, absolutely.
No, that's a scary thought. So get your underwriting done early.
Yeah, again, it's yet another reason to go and get your underwriting done early. And can I say, don't ever be tempted to not tell an insurer something when you're going through the questions, because that comes under your duty of disclosure. So in the event of a claim, even 5 years down the track, they can go back through, and they will, if it's a serious claim, they will get a copy of your Medicare history, your medical benefit scheme history, and they will be able to check things out. And they have the right then to cancel your policy, give you back your premiums that you've paid. And to them, the policy never existed. The contract never was in force.
Yeah, that makes sense, and goes without saying. If you do something like that, they're definitely going to find out that's what they're paid to do, or that's how they make their money in a way, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. So, and it was one of the criticisms of insurance companies with the Royal Commission, where there was such a pressure, such a sales mentality with life insurance companies, that when they were in a growing phase, they wanted to take on everyone, and they would have cheap insurance rates, they would have lax underwriting or relaxed underwriting guidelines, and they would take on all of this business. And then after 5 or 6 years, all of a sudden, this in inverted commas, poor quality business that they took on and didn't underwrite properly, start and go on claims. So then the knee-jerk reaction comes in, and they slam the brakes on, and then underwriting clamps right down, and that's it. Then they don't take on anyone, which all it does really is, it doesn't help anyone, because people are then they start and investigate claims and look for any way to get out of them. So, we want to find the right insurer. We want to make sure that you fully disclose all of your medical history, so that you can be confident that in the future, if something happens, your claim will be paid for as long as you need it to be paid.
Yeah, absolutely. When going for income protection early on, I found pretty early on it was a bit hard to prove income, and then they just put you on an assumed income, I think it was. How does that work? Because you don't have proof of income when you're a graduate. You don't even have a job before that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I'm certainly not here to bag insurers at all. I think they do a fantastic job. And one of the areas that they really have recognized the medical profession in particular is that they understand that you go through university, you graduate 24, 25 years of age, and they also recognize you have quite an accelerated income path. So, for example, you might graduate. And one of the problems we have is that you graduate at the end of 1 year. So in the middle of a financial year, and you start say, early the next year, you work at the end of that financial year, you've only worked for 5 or 6 months. So then you've got to work another 12 months before you actually got a full year's earnings. So what the insurers do is they offer, most of them offer what they call a new professional or a new graduate's offer. So the insurance policy itself is no different at all. But what it is it's where the insurer will say, look, we understand the headaches you have with being able to prove your earnings. But what we do believe is that at some stage in the first 5 years of you working, you will generally earn a taxable income of around or of at least $160,000. So most of the insurers will offer their graduates a guaranteed sum insured of $10,000 per month, irrespective of what your earnings are. So you could take it out on the first day you start work, have earned $100 for that career so far, go on and claim on day two, and they guarantee they will pay you $10,000 a month on claim.
That's good to hear because it's such an important thing. Dentists, we change our income very quickly in the first year or first 5 years, I'm sure. So if you insure yourself right in the first month, it's not going to be worth it. But because of that offer by the companies, it makes sense to do it as soon as you can.
And it allows you to grow into your income. So you can set up your income protection policy. Then you really don't need to worry about it for the next 2 or 3 years. So until your income has grown to exceed that $160,000, you don't need to worry about reviewing it again. So you can just get on with, you don't have to worry about getting tax returns done straight away or anything like that. You can grow into it. And then at your annual review, once your income's well and truly surpassed that, then you can always look at increasing your sum insured at that time. So it's a real peace of mind aspect.
So. Yeah, definitely. So I guess you would consult with your advisor about that. And apart from contacting you, Mark, who can we trust for this kind of thing? Who should we be reaching out to?
Talk to your peers, can I say? Talk to your peers that have a good relationship with their advisor. In life, I find that, there's a lot of Facebook groups around. It's the same way that if you look for an accountant, who do you go to? You don't go to Google. With all due respect to Google, Google is where we go to check to see if we spelt a word correctly or where a restaurant is. But in regards to things like financial services, insurance, legal, accounting, it's also the greatest source of misinformation because nearly 100% of the information on Google is sponsored content. So you're going to get a product provider's rosy view of their particular product. So I suggest go to your peers, find out who they use and their experience and talk to them. So it doesn't have to be someone local. With the internet these days, you can, I've got clients all over Australia, but make sure that you deal with someone that your peers have worked with and have shown that they're there to act in your best interest, not just there to write a policy, get paid a commission, and let me know if you need to increase it in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Is a dental specific one? You've talked about your medical specific now, and obviously you thought that was a good idea. What are some of the pitfalls of just going with any advisor?
Well, the problem is a classic example is I had was referred a dentist, and she had been to just a general advisor and set up a policy. And he actually set up the policy quite well. He set it up on an agreed value with a multi-tiered disability definition. And then she had a cut to her hand, which resulted in nerve damage. So with nerve damage, it can take quite a while for the nerves to grow back. And it was in a dominant hand, so it took a little while. Whilst she was off work totally, the claim went along without any issues. But when I met her, she was really upset at this particular insurance company because she was upset with the way they handled her claim when she went back to work. Because she was a practice owner, As soon as she went back to work, they asked her for a copy of her profit and loss. And because, you know, her practice was trading profitably, they said, well, hang on a second, we're going to offset the profit that the practice is generating against the benefit we're paying you. So there you go. This is, we're not going to pay you your $12,000 a month. We're going to pay you $3,000 a month. And she was quite upset. It really came down to, when I had a look at her policy had the policy wording that allowed her to actually return to work up to 10 hours a week, every week, and still be considered on a full claim. Now, on a full claim, she doesn't need to provide any financial evidence. So the bad experience she had with that policy was not because of the advisor and the way he set it up. It was the fact that this advisor didn't understand how the policy definition worked. She's now subsequently, she went back to work. She's now been to her neurologist and she needs another minor surgery to clear up some scar tissue. And she's back to working and I'm helping manage her claim. And she's now back to work just 9 hours a week and she's getting paid a full benefit.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So understanding those clauses is obviously, pretty critical. Are there other clauses that you've heard of, like specific cases where people have been called out in a similar way?
The capability clause is a big one.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one you want to avoid. The other thing is that I see now bloodborne disease infection is a big matter, big issue with your particular occupation. Now, with income protection, there's two ways you can have it. So you can either have it as a disability definition. So if you were to become occupationally acquired HIV positive, you can make a claim on your income protection and that'll be considered a claimable event and you'll go and benefit. If your policy, or you can actually take out a separate lump sum benefit. So what that means is the policy itself, you can't make a claim on your income protection policy, but if you become HIV positive, you can get paid this one-off lump sum. Now, the difference between the two is that, from my view, you would take the policy that has it as a disability definition all day, every day. Because if you're young and depending on your sum insured, you're looking at being paid a benefit of up to $8 million over the life of the policy, as opposed to a one-off lump sum benefit. It might be $500,000, whatever sum you choose. But then that's the only money you've got left to live on for the rest of your working life.
Mm. So, that's a huge difference.
For me, only about half of the policies in Australia for income protection actually consider needle stick injuries as a claimable disability definition. And for my view, as a dentist, that should be number one on your hit list. You need to make sure that it considers. Thankfully, I mean, in Australia, needle stick injuries are not uncommon with dentists, but thankfully the rate of positive transmission of HIV, Hep B and C is incredibly low.
Yeah.
But you don't want to be the person whose picture is in that medical dictionary saying that you were the one who was unlucky enough to get successful transmission. My view is that you can have both. You can have a policy that considers needle stick injury as a disability definition and you can pay extra for needle stick cover as a lump sum to have both. But my view is it's a waste of money. But it's a waste of money to have the additional lump sum cover. The chance or the risk of infection is so low, save that money and spend it on total and permanent disability or trauma insurance. But you would never, in my view, consider an income protection policy that doesn't consider that.
No, that's a really good point.
So from that side of it, absolutely. Some of the other things that I have seen with income protection, you can take it out on either an agreed value basis. So that's where the insurer bases it on your income at time of application, or under the new graduate's offer, they give you that guaranteed endorsed agreed value, sum insured. Or you can take it out on what they call an indemnity basis. So indemnity effectively means they'll pay you 75% of your income at the time of claim. So some people find an indemnity policy attractive because they might be in the public hospital system where they're on a fixed wage and it's a little bit cheaper. But the danger of that is that, like a lot of things with insurance, we tend to set them and forget them. They then become go out on their own, become a contractor, start and work on commissions, earn up a good living, and then they move into practice ownership, or there's been a change in their health. Then they want to lock in because of, as a contractor, depending on, you know, if you don't work, you don't earn. If you know, you want to make sure that if something happens, if you want to start a family or something along those lines, you're going to need to take some time off. Your income's going to drop a bit. You want to lock in that income. You know, on an indemnity basis, if you want to change to agreed, you've got to go through that underwriting again. If you're on indemnity and you want to set up or buy a practice, and say that practice has three chairs and they're all pretty busy chairs. Now, those three chairs, a three-chair practice is generally, if they're busy, is going to be a pretty profitable practice. So the issue you've got there is that if you're going to make a claim as a practice owner with a three-chair practice on an indemnity policy, the first thing they're going to say is, give us your tax return and give us the profit and loss from the practice. As soon as they see that the practice is generating profit, they're going to offset the profits that it generates, and they're going to pay you what's left out of your benefit. Even though you've been paying a premium for a higher sum insured, they will pay you what your income will justify at that time with all things considered. So think of agreed value as future-proofing your benefit for those things that in life, whether it be practice ownership or doing a bit of travel and your income drops or starting a family and your income drops, it's future-proofing. So again, it's one of these things that in life, There's places we can save some money, but there's also things that we don't scrimp on. We want to make sure that, you know, you've got a good quality product and that it's set up right, not just now, but for the future.
That's a really good point. You don't want to skimp on this. And if you're going to do it, why would you cut corners and then not be insured when you thought you were insured? So these little clauses and bits and pieces, it's so important to get right. So it's important not to skimp on insurance so that we can, you know, get to that situation, hopefully never use it. We might need to claim. What do we need to know about claiming? Hopefully we never need to actually use this, but what do we need to know?
Absolutely. So a couple of things. One is that in the event of a claim, contact your advisor. For example, if you've taken out the right policy, you'll be covered for needle stick injury. So there's no problems there. However, on all of the policies, you do have a duty to report to the insurer within 7 days the incident of a needle stick injury. And then also you will need to provide copies of the two follow-up blood tests that you will get. Okay, that's really important because that establishes a baseline and an incident to make sure that it was occupationally acquired, not through lifestyle or you know, nefarious behavior of any sort. So that's number one.
Those blood tests, is that same day and then a follow-up?
And that's really comes down to most practices sort of, and I think your governing body has certain procedures in place that you need to have a blood test done, I think, within 5 days. And then I think it's about 3 months to make sure there hasn't been any conversion. So it's just really, I mean, you do that anyway for the practice and for your patient and for your own sake. And then so you don't need to do specific tests. It'll just furnish them with copies of the test that you would get done as a matter of course for the practice.
Yeah, okay.
Also, too, it's really important that you contact your advisor, not just if you know you need to make a claim, but also if you think you may need to make a claim. Even if then so that it's noted, because, you know, a lot of time with joint injuries or muscular pain or whatever, I'm going to work through it. I think I'm going to be okay. I should be all right. If talk to your advisor, then they'll advise about whether you need to go and see a doctor, because effectively an insurer will take that the start of your waiting period from the time that you go and seek treatment. They don't recognize chiropractors. They don't recognize Bowen therapists and things like that. It's it's got to be a GP or a medical specialist or a hospital or something along those lines. So that's then draws a line in the sand for your waiting period.
Yeah, that's a really good point. If you've got a 30-day waiting period and you spend 15 days just thinking it'll be all right, you've made a big mistake. If you say you go into say you got shoulder pain, for instance, and you think it's occupational, it doesn't really matter, and you go into your GP and talk about it, you've already been underwritten. So is it, there's no risk of having limitations on your policy unless you get underwritten again. Is that right?
That's right. And the way that a good quality insurance policy will be set up is that they'll allow you to increase your sum insured each year without any underwriting based upon an increase in your income. Mm. So the way to be for that to be covered off. So that way then you know going your health is number one. Get your policy set up. Health is number one. If you need to make a claim, get treatment. Talk to your advisor because you can, depending on the policy wording, you can work through the waiting period. But again, you want to make sure that whether that's under the 10 hours or if it's going to be deemed as a return to work and things like that. So it really is essential that you talk to your advisor even through the start of a wait. Once a claim has been established and accepted by the insurer, as I mentioned before, one, you stop paying premiums. So effectively what happens is the insurer will, if you're paying monthly, the insurer will still draw the premiums from your bank account. But what they do is if you're insured for $10,000 a month and your premiums are $200 a month, when they pay you, they'll pay you $10,200 a month. So they'll reimburse you for the premium. So then keep in mind too that once you've made a claim, they can't come back and change the terms of the policy on it at all in the future. And also too, so say if you're off work, I have clients who say to me, I had, for example, carpal tunnel syndrome, and just on one wrist, I'm only going to be off work for 5 weeks. I've got a 30-day wait. I'm going to get paid 1 week. Is it really worth making a claim? And my answer to that is yes, purely because for any one condition, you only serve that waiting period once every 12 months. So say in that exact scenario, carpal tunnel syndrome, you go and get the release surgery, you're off work for 5 weeks, you get paid 1 week's benefit, and you're back to work. So from the date that you return to work, if that condition causes you to have any time off work again in the next 12 months, you don't serve that waiting period. So if, say, in 3 months' time, you get a relapse or it hasn't been successful and you need to take another 3 weeks off, you'll get paid for that 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's a really important decision, obviously. And then if you need, just a little bit more rehabilitation, you can take it without feeling the financial pressure at the same time.
100%.
All right, that's really good. I'll tell you what, we've covered a lot about insurance. I didn't know we could talk for so long about insurance, but I'm sure you've done it before. Is there any other tips or things you want to cover for graduates?
It really comes down to, and I've said them throughout it, think of insurance as an investment. You know, you don't want to, if you're investing in the stock market, you don't want to invest in what they call penny dreadfuls, and you want to invest in good blue chip shares. Think of insurance as the same way. Take out good quality insurance. Develop a relationship with your advisor, okay? That really is important because you do want to have good access to that advisor. Make sure that they understand your field. They want to understand how dentistry works, not just now as an associate, but also into practice ownership so that they can grow with you and come along your journey through your career. It's really important. They're really the three main things. It's the value of advice. Invest in good quality insurance and don't scrimp on the premiums. It's in particular with income protection, it's so important.
That's really good advice, Mark. And I think a lot of graduates, we generally don't know very much about this. And it's something I think it's really important. I've seen it used. You've obviously seen it used hundreds of times and saved people's lives, literally. So thank you for taking the time and sharing that with the Dental Head Start community. And we really appreciate that. How can people reach out to you if they wanted to ask a question or get in touch?
Please feel free. You can make contact with me via, I'm on Facebook. You can email me at mark@clearfp.com.au. Call me on my mobile 0413-002-825. Give me a call, email, SMS, anything that you want, touch base, and I'm more than happy to discuss your personal situation. And one thing I do pride myself on is that if you have an advisor and you're happy with your advisor and the policy's been set up right, I'll be the first person to tell you that they've done absolutely a sterling job and to stay with it, because I'm not here to take anyone's clients. What I do want to make sure, though, is that your insurances are set up right so that in the future, if something does go wrong, you can rely on those insurances and have your expectations met at claim time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate you saying that, because that's important. I can tell you're passionate about getting people, you know, getting their insurance right and making sure people aren't making mistakes. So we appreciate the person we can rely on. That sounds great. Thanks again for sharing your time, Mark. I appreciate it very much.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Dave, and thanks so much for inviting me onto your podcast. I've really enjoyed the opportunity, so thank you.
So welcome back. Have you got your insurance sorted yet? Definitely made me think a lot about mine and make sure things are exactly how they should be. So thanks, Mark, for sharing your wisdom. If you want to get in touch with Mark, you can find his website at rothneyfs.com.au or find the links in the show notes. I'd like to say thanks for the support we've got early on with this podcast. It's been fun, and I really hope we've been able to share some important information for graduates and students out there. So if you are enjoying this, we'd really appreciate if you follow us on Facebook or Instagram. Give us all your feedback you can and suggest guests that you'd like to hear from. And of course, if you rate us on iTunes or any of the podcast apps, it really does help us get seen by others. For now, thanks for listening. Catch you next time.